Blog Talk Radio. Anxiety. Better Choices for Life is a self-help podcast created by Yulia and Nakul, who each have years of experience helping people all over the world improve their mindset and their habits, and now they're bringing together their experience in this podcast. They offer free tools, techniques, and inspiration to help improve the quality of your life. Better Choices for Life is a coaching guide with a focus on giving you practical tips that you can start applying right away. The first season has 12 episodes focused on overcoming anxiety, and the first 3 episodes are available now. So do you have problems with public speaking? Get stage fright? Episodes 2, 3, and 4 focus on what to do before, during, and after your presentation and help you get better at public speaking. It's easy to see why Better Choices for Life is currently featured in the new and noteworthy section on iTunes. Yulia and Nakul also offer one-on-one coaching via video conference, and you can find out more information on their website at www.betterchoices.life.
Good evening and welcome to Madam Perry Salon. I am your host and cruise director, Jennifer Madam Perry. And as many of you know, Madam Perry Salon began as a blog, but I wanted a feel of like an old arts and culture salon of Europe and Asia and Britain centuries past, where people would meet in the home of a patroness and read their work, play new songs, and share and discuss things or events of the day. And so when I started with the blog, I usually had at least a co-interviewer for that. And now we're on the air. And I am delighted to say that tonight my guest is author and poet Bunny Goodjohn. Bunny, welcome to Madam Perry Salon.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you for having me.
I'm delighted to have you here. And, of course, you were also in the blog, Madam Perry Salon.
That seems like an age ago, but I was. How long ago was that?
I think it might, it could have been about 2 years.
Yeah, I think it was.
Two? And if I think it's 2 years, yeah, that means it probably was 3.
It's nice to be here with you, and not quite in person, but in voice.
We're getting closer. Yeah, we're getting closer. I'm in Atlanta, you're in Lynchburg, Virginia, so we're getting closer there.
I know.
Well, you don't sound like you're from Lynchburg.
Well, I'm not, and I must admit that I'm a little bit self-conscious this evening. I'm from London originally, and I've been here in the States since 1999, and I guess my accent has become a fusion of London meets Lynchburg, which is a little strange. But I did a recording on Facebook about 4 weeks ago. I read a poem by a friend of mine, Robert McNally, and I thought it went really well, and then a friend of mine from my hometown contacted me and kind of called me out. He said that I sounded Australian. So now I'm really conscious of whether it's, I'm not sure whether it's the words that I choose or my tone or what it is, but I definitely don't sound like the London girl that I was when I left in 1999, but that's what happens when you move to another country.
Well, that's how I felt when I moved to Asheville, too. But they didn't. In fact, even I was working for a while in a little store up there, and even though it was a pretty large population of Russians and Ukrainian and Spanish, Mexican people in North Carolina, as you may know, being near. And even they would say, you're not from here, are you? So, you don't sound like the other people here. So, well, I know I've sound Southern, but not like, it's different from these. So, yeah, it's just a big difference in that. So, well, oh, and by the way, I opened with the bit there, a roll-in for Better Choices for Life, which is a podcast by Eula and Nicole. And it says at the end, do you have trouble with public speaking? Well, I obviously not only have trouble with that, but I have trouble with buttons. So Mexico Lifestyle Services was going to go on first. So if you're listening, Ms. Winkleman, that I told you that it would be on first, it'll be on in about 25 minutes, sure. I am so sorry. I just got excited and pushed the wrong button. Or maybe I could blame it on the corgis. I don't know. I don't think I can. Anyway, but it'll all be good.
Blame it on the dogs.
Yeah. See, if people don't know how short they are, you can usually get away with that. All right. But let's get to the main thing, the reason they were here for. Very excited that you have launched your first book of poetry. And it's called Bonesome.
Yeah.
And not only that, but we put right up in front. It's published by Briary Creek Press.
That's right.
And
they're actually a small independent publisher out of Longwood University, from Farmville in Virginia. So we're keeping it very local.
Oh, that's very nice. And Bonesong won the 2014 Liam Rector First Book Prize for Poetry. That's got to feel good.
It does feel good. It was one of those strange, a strange set of circumstances. I had a really good spring in that I had received word from a small publisher in California to say that that they were going to take my novel, my second novel. So I was completely kind of trippy about that one. And then about 3 weeks later, I had a phone call from Briary Creek Press to tell me that I had won this 2014 Liam Rector Prize, and that part of that prize was going to be publication. So, my cup could not have been fuller of things to run us over. I had a second book of fiction out and a book of poetry. So,
that
year was great, and this year is even better because both books are actually being published this year. So,
it's got to be a magnificent feeling.
It is for a little while. There's a part of you, there's a part of me anyway that thinks, oh, good, I can kind of rest and sit back a little bit now. But that doesn't last for very long. I think that part of the writing life for me is fueled by a kind of a fear-based compulsion. I wrote that and I wrote this. Now, is that it? Like, have I written the last decent thing I'll ever write? So you get back to it, So now I'm in that place where all my good stuff has been published and I've got to start generating some new work. So,
Now, too, I think one of the, as I understand it, one of the bonuses about your job, you're a college professor.
Sounds very swanky. If somebody would have told me when I was 15 and a half, when I left school, that, I would end up being a college professor at a small liberal arts college in Lynchburg, Virginia, I would have laughed at them. But, yeah, that's what I am now. I have to pinch myself on a regular basis. When people call me Professor Goodjohn, that still kind of floors me a little bit.
Well, now, wait a minute. So what you're saying is you left school at 15 and a half.
I did. Yes,
okay.
And
you hadn't graduated from high school yet, or what do you call it there?
Well, it's kind of strange in England. We have a slightly different system to the American system in that you don't sit for one examination at the end, like your GED. What happens in your last year at school is you sit for a whole host of exams, as if you were, I don't know, I suppose as if you were taking a major or something. And then when you finally leave the premises, as it were, they tell you how many of those exams you passed. So, and depending on how many exams you passed, you go on to sixth form or college or whatever. And I guess so, that the statute of limitations is over now, so I can be very honest. I passed one exam out of seven, and that was art. And I failed all of the other ones, although I did fib about that for about 3 years and pretended to have passed French and English as well. And I got away with it because my school burnt down. So all of the records were lost, which was rather good
for
me.
Is that what the statute of limitations comment was about?
Yes, I think so, because all of my professional career has been predicated on me having three O-levels rather than just the one that I scraped through with. So yeah. So yes, yeah, so when somebody, you know, calls me Professor Goodjohn, I do a little bit of a double take. But, you know, I teach what I love. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, you have to love what you teach and you have to know what you're talking about. And I think I've got both of those under control.
I think you really do. You know, I was going to say, you know, there was a few years back when I was I had a part-time gig in this might have been actually 15 or 20 years back, a part-time gig in underground Atlanta, if this place, at as a fortune teller. One of my booking agents put me down there, and hey, a girl's got to turn a buck. So,
right. So
in other words, if you had been sat down at my table, and I had told you that's where you'd be, you know, you'd be one of the people going, oh, she's a fraud.
I would have wanted my money back, Jennifer.
I'd be going, yeah, get in line. So,
right.
That's wow. That's something. But the good thing though about working with being a college professor is that they not only they encourage you and they're proud of
right.
you when you publish and they want you to publish. What is the expression, publish or perish?
You know, that's really true. And my arrival in academia as a college professor really came about because when I got to 40 years old and I emigrated here to America, I couldn't get a job in America because I didn't have a degree. So at that point, I went back to school. So I went back for a four-year undergraduate, discovered that I loved to write, went off and did my master's, and then came back to my alma mater to teach. So I've kind of come full circle. But this whole thing about publish or perish, the whole idea of a creative writing terminal degree, the MFA, has become so popular in the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years. But there are so many wonderful writers coming out of these programs, and they're all desperate for work. You know, they all want to teach. So there's a lot of competition out there. So it's easier to sort of secure that first job if you have a book in your hand, but you better keep publishing in order to either keep that job or to move from perhaps adjunct up to, you know, associate assistant professor level. So it's dog eat dog. There's a lot of fine writers out there chasing very, very few publishing contracts.
Wow. So it's a little tougher than we on the outside think it is.
But, you know, it's a changing environment in that now it's possible that there's more ways to publish now, of course. We can self-publish, we can publish online, but there's many more options. So that really means that there's a lot more books out there to read, and we're not breeding more readers, you know. If anything, I'm not going to say that, well, I am going to say it. I think fewer people are reading. Or maybe fewer people are reading things in a sustained way. I think the ability to sit, or the willingness to sit down for an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours with a book is becoming something a party piece. You know, I think
mm-hmm.
we're getting more and more used to receiving our entertainment in short bursts, which is why I love poetry. You can't get much shorter than a poem.
No.
I think even if we lose our ability to sustain any kind of reading for more than 8 minutes, I'm in with a chance.
Yeah, you know, like I tell people, it's a short attention span world.
It is. It really is.
And part of that, of course, is that we're, you know, when I tell people, or as a publicist, when I tell clients how many places and how many times people need to see their name or their book title or their book or their cover or their picture or something, they just see it and hear it so many times everywhere they turn, is because of that, where it's a short attention span world and people need to have it so many times in their mind or they won't forget. And this is not that I'm calling people stupid, but your brain, everyone is assaulted, all of your senses, you know, hearing and your sight and everything around you. You know, sit down at to eat in a restaurant, and if the people nearby you aren't playing with their cell phones or something, they're looking over your head at a television, and you know there's just everything, something going on all the time. So everything is in competition for attention.
Right. So
there's every short, but a poet, you know, a book of poetry, you can just take it and open it up anywhere. And have a little escape at something.
Yeah, I think that's beauty. And I think I'm hoping that maybe the poem's becoming more accessible to people. I have a poem delivered daily to my inbox on my iPad. So when I wake up in the morning, I've got, you know, the streams of emails from Facebook and Etsy and everywhere else that I hang out. And then there's always one poem from, it's called the Writer's Almanac. And so they deliver this poem, and then there's a little bit at the bottom that kind of says all the interesting things that happened in the literary world and the anniversaries. But the wonderful thing is it's read by Garrison Keillor. Now,
I was about to ask you that,
because
that's where I
lie in bed listening to Garrison Keillor read me a poem. I mean, life doesn't get any better than that at that point, does it? It's just like wonderful. So, I think that this idea of having poems delivered to you is wonderful, and there's lots and lots of online sites that are doing that. So maybe this is going to be the revival of the poem as a popular cultural form. Let's hope so.
I hope so as well, because, well, for one thing, I knew, you know, Writer's Almanac was read Garrison Keillor, but I was not aware that it could be delivered to you in a daily email.
There's no effort involved whatsoever. You just have to, you know, either click on it or touch it, and there you have it.
How nice. And then, too, poetry, and I'm thinking a lot, and I don't know, I'm certainly not well, don't know a lot about poetry. Most of what I know, besides what I enjoy and read myself, I've learned from my friend Colin Kelly. But and the poets that he's introduced me to.
Right.
However, when I read your poems and some of Colin's poems and other people, I feel like I've got a condensed story. Instead of going through, you know, instead of where somebody has gone on, you know, describing, everything is very succinct and it's very pointed, and the emotions or the information or the feeling is right there for me.
Right. I think I'm a huge lover of the narrative poem. I mean, I love all poems. No, that's not true. I don't love all poems. There's some poems that I really don't like, but I prefer the narrative form, the story form. I like I can handle lyric poetry where it's more emotion based. I'm okay with that, but some of it, I get to the end of it and I really don't understand it. And I'm a simple soul, and I like to get to the end of something and feel like I understand something, that I've got something from it. So I think that's why I love narrative poetry more, because, as you say, it's like having a tiny story delivered to you on the page. And they have such a long tradition of narrative poetry has been around for centuries, and it's a way of telling our life's stories to a wider audience.
Well, it's a tiny story, but size does not matter. Here, right?
Yes, that's very true.
I see. And when you say a simple soul, I don't know about that, because I always love this quote from Sarah Kennedy, who's the author of The Golden Thread, when she says, mm-hmm. if I may read this, she says, Bunny Goodjohn's poems, as her title suggests, cut right to the bone, singing of pain and sickness, of everyday cruelty and lost love. She traces the scars of childhood along an adult's memories. Oh, my gosh. You know,
yeah.
I mean, that.
Yeah, when she's, because what you have to do when you publish a book is you're meant to go out and collect your jacket blurbs, those things on the back, and I had to think about the two poets who I, you know, which poets do I really respect, who do I love, and who could I maybe stand a chance of getting, you know, them to read my email or my letter, and Sarah Kennedy, I have so much time for her. She is such a lady and such a shrewd poet. So when she said that, when I read the email, because she sent me the text, the copy first, and I read it, I thought, oh, my goodness, that is what I do. It's kind of like she found stuff in my work that I wasn't really aware of on the surface as being there. And I sat with that idea of scars. You know, she traces the scars of childhood along an adult's memories. And I was thinking, you know, that when we have scars, I mean, they mark something as having happened to us, but they also mark a healing of that thing. You know, if there's no scar, it's not healed. And whilst the scar might not be very pretty, it's a mark of having moved on. So I like to think that this book, whilst it goes to some pretty dark places, that there is a sense of... maybe redemption at the end, or at least having arrived in a different place, a place that personally I feel much more comfortable with. I'm much more comfortable in my skin now at 55 than I ever have been, I think. Yeah, I think that's true. I'm happier now at 55 than I ever have been.
Well, that's a good feeling.
It's a great feeling. I wish I'd used more moisturizer, but that's probably my only regret.
You know, I have a comment for you from one of my favorite people, who is also a poet,
uh-huh.
And he usually messages me his questions for guests, and they're always the best. And you know him; he's a poet, author, and the publisher of Subtlety, who interviewed you.
Oh, David.
David Hurley. Yeah, he says, he said, let's see, he's listening, he says, Bunny does, and does is capitalized, Bunny does have a little bit of an Australian tinge to her accent, but it's a cute twinge, Naomi Watts-like.
I am so un-Naomi Watts-like. But that's very sweet of David to say so. You know, the internet is a very strange thing. I've not met you, Jennifer, and I've not met David, and I've not met many people that I speak to on a regular basis. But David got me to say stuff in that interview that you know, I probably wouldn't have said to somebody face to face.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think that there's I've been thinking about this a lot because I've got the launch party on Thursday. And at that point, I'm going to stand up behind a microphone and a podium in a quite an intimate room. And I'm going to read this stuff. And there is a sense in the past when I've read fiction that it's fiction. You know, it's not about me. I've just written it, and it's fiction. It's all make-believe. But in Bonesong, 90% of this is autobiographical, and 10% is poetic license. My plan is to not reveal which 10% is poetic license, because I'm also going to send this book to my mom, you know, and that's a whole different conversation too. But I guess what I'm saying is with fiction. You can hide. With poetry, you can't. So when I did that interview with David and he was asking me some very thorough questions, I couldn't do anything other than give him very, very thorough answers.
And it is interesting the way that you know, social media and the internet and so forth has brought, can bring people together. I mean, yeah, there's crazy stuff people talk about, and yet at the same time, I've met some of the most fascinating people whom I would have never had a chance to meet. I've met you.
Right.
I don't even remember how we met on
Facebook. You
know,
I've been thinking about this, and off air, I think I'm gonna ask you about how we might have met, because I think I remember now.
Really?
But yes.
Was it something bad that I said?
I'm pretty sure it was online.
Well, you can go ahead and say it now, maybe.
Well, I think it was, I think it was, we were on Facebook and we have a mutual friend, Mr. Bassett, I think.
Tom Bassett, yes.
And
whom I've never met
either. You commented on one of his threads, and I commented back, and I think that that was the tenuous beginning of you and I knowing each other. I think we met on a Facebook thread. How romantic is that?
Wow. Tom Bassett, you know, he took off from Facebook and all social media to finish work on a book, and I haven't seen, unless he's just left me out of the loop, unless I've offended somehow, but, you know, he hasn't returned to me. Have you talked to Tom lately? Bunny? Okay, I feel like maybe, okay, have I lost you because I don't hear you, so I'll tell you what. I am going to go ahead and play a nice little advert that I made for a company called Mexico Lifestyle Services. And when we come back, hopefully, we're going to talk more about Bone Song, about Bunny Good John's event Thursday night in, she's going to be at the YMCA, the Lynchburg. It's the Lynchburg YMCA. It's where she's having her event Thursday night, this Thursday at 7. And then there will be some other events. And in fact, if you would like for Bunny Good John to come to where you live, if you've got, I don't care if it's a library or YW, oh, no, she's going to be at a YWCA. Let me make that clear. It's the Lynchburg YWCA this Thursday, the 18th at 7 o'clock. And there's going to be food, nibbly things. There's going to be another person reading. There's going to be some maybe some music. It's going to be a nice evening. And if you would like for her to come and read somewhere else and have a book event, she has got summer pretty free because she's a teacher, so she can travel a little bit. Let her know, or let me know, and I'll pass the word on to her. So when we come back, I think Bunny Good John is going to hopefully read to us from Bone Song.
Jen, I'm back. I think I lost connection.
There you are. There you are.
Hey.
Okay. All right. So anyway, as I was saying, it happens sometimes. As I was saying, you are having your launch of Bone Song this Thursday, the 18th, at about 7 p.m. because it's going to be food, nibbly things, and you're going to be reading. It's the Lynchburg YWCA.
It's and I've got quite a nice evening planned. I decided it's kind of like my party, and I can do what I like, which is a lovely feeling. So I have a very good friend of mine, Nan Carmack Kreitzer, who is going to be emceeing for me. I met Nan a good few years ago. She used to run an independent bookstore in Forest, Virginia, called Bookends. And I walked in there one day and asked if she wanted to start a slam poetry event once a month. So that's how we got together, and we write together now. So she's going to open for, or she's going to be up my MC. And then I just have this wonderful poet called Jer Bryant, who teaches here in Lynchburg College, and he's going to be opening for about 10 minutes just because I love his poetry, and then I'll come on after that.
A lot of writers are doing that. I think that is so cool. Now, he's at Lynchburg College. You're at Randolph College.
That's right. We're separated by about 5 minutes in the car. And when I first started teaching, I used to adjunct at Lynchburg College. So we're all pretty incestuous here. You know, we kind of all know each other. We have Lynchburg College. We have Randolph College. Unfortunately, we used to have Sweetbriar, but, you know, they're in the middle of a close down now.
But
and
I'm
of
reading
course, we have
some,
liberty.
Yeah, something going
Sorry?
On about. I'm reading different things about Sweetbriar. Somebody's saying that it's illegal to shut it down. I don't know. But there, I have a caller on the line, Bunny.
Great.
I'm sorry. Hello. This is Madam Perry, and I'm with Bunny Goodjohn. Welcome.
Hello,
hello, caller. Hey.
Hi there.
Hi.
From Asheville.
Hi.
Hello, Denton,
so, yeah.
All the way from Asheville.
Yeah, North Carolina. So, yeah, Bonnie, congratulations on your new book. I wish I could make it to Lynchburg, but alas, I'm too far away.
Oh,
but,
well, that's a shame. I think what I might do once the launch is over is that, you know, I'm kind of getting into this idea of online radio. I heard that what you can do is you can turn your closet into a really good home studio. So I might play with that and maybe record a few of these poems and put them up on my website.
I think it's a good idea.
Well,
yeah.
That's a good idea.
And you can go to Asheville, too.
You know, I could. There's nothing stopping me, is there, Jennifer?
It's a hip town.
It is. Asheville's a hip little town, and
it is.
That would be good. Yeah, we had Colin Kelly was in Asheville a few weeks ago reading.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, a great little place. I know just the place for you. Okay,
well, you'll have to set it
thank
up,
you.
And we'll make it happen.
Oh, I'll make it happen, all right. Denton, thanks so much for calling.
Certainly, thank
yep.
you.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, thanks. Okay, well, I'm going to play this little advert for Mexico Lifestyle Services. And I've never been to Mexico. Have you, Bunny?
I have. The last vacation with my second ex-husband was in Mexico. I got horrible food poisoning, but I did get a rather nice blanket out of it.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll tell you what, I think I'm the only person that's never been to Mexico. And
right.
So, but listen to this commercial. I think after I hear this, I think we need to plan a Bone Song event in Mexico.
That'd be great.
I don't think this place will let us get sick. Let's listen to this. And when we come back, will you read for us?
Yes, certainly.
Wonderful. Mexico Lifestyle Services is a luxury concierge services company located in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. We pride ourselves on taking care of any of your travel desires, from private transportation, the best restaurant recommendations, customized tours and activities, to private chefs, shopping, and spa treatments. We can provide you with anything you could possibly need. Our team of experts have selected the finest accommodations and providers in the area to deliver the highest quality you might desire. Mexico is a majestic place where we make luxury a standard. Do you desire top-notch service with endless options while in Bay of Banderas, Mexico? Or a world of adventure and swashbuckling action amongst the pirate ship tour? Let Mexico Lifestyle Services take care of your every need. Visit us at mexicolifestyle.com.mx. All right. What do you think of that, Bunny? That's a lot. That doesn't sound like we're going to get sick there.
I don't think so. You know, I think I just went on the cheap. I think I need to learn to spend a bit of money on my vacations, and maybe I'll have a much better time.
Yeah. Some things are kind of, some travel is kind of dodgy. You never know.
But I
think I would trust Mexico Lifestyle Services
very much.
Yeah. All right. So if you said you'd read for us.
Yeah. Do you have anything in mind, or should I just pick something?
I'd like for you to choose one.
Okay. Well, gosh, which one? Okay, I think I'm going to read a poem that's called, it's entitled Association Time at the Blue Ridge Women's Correctional Facility. And I'm choosing this poem because it's dedicated to a lady called Vicky, who unfortunately isn't with us anymore. But that's true of a number of my good friends, and readers of the book will work out why that is, and I'm happy to talk about it with you, Jennifer. But let's let's do this poem, and then we'll talk a bit more.
Okay.
Okay. Association time at the Blue Ridge Women's Correctional Facility. Deaf Brenda's telling us about the time her husband smacked her with a cockatiel's cage stand, how sound closed down that night, and yet her memory holds the parrot's scream. She recalls slow feathers, tiny gray curls, landing on her yellow fun fur slippers. We lean in. She's telling our story, and we love how they all start happy with sass and drinks. She threw his sorry ass outside, piled furniture against the door, then took her whiskey and the kids to bed, slept sound despite the ricochet of words against the trailer's siding. There is no recollection of clubbing him with the iron, but there it was, bloody and shining on the deck. What can I say, she said, her yard full of police and plastic toys, her hands already clasped behind her back. Drink brings a crazy bitch to fuck up my life. My turn for tales, but I'm just here for plain old DUI. So I tell the girls of Rita, patron saint of suffering, whose mouth was home to bees that buzzed behind her teeth but left her tongue unstung, a saint I'd forgotten till deaf Brenda described her tinnitus as bee song. The rec room hums, and we're all lost to joining drunken dots of our own blacked-out biographies. We're haunted by mouths that have always swarmed with bees, homesick for a time when we were too blessed or young to know the treachery of swallowing. So that poem came from, as I say, a woman that I knew who was in the local jail system. And there are an awful lot of women, Jennifer, who sit in jails awaiting trials for offenses that are predicated usually, too many times, on alcohol or drugs. And it breaks my heart. It just breaks my heart. Mm-hmm. So I loved Vicky to pieces, but she didn't make it out. And that's a great shame, because I think that she would have, that she certainly had done some things in her life to turn things round. But it's ironic. She died of a burst appendix. And, you know, it's one of those things that's very sad. But that's where the poetry comes from. Poetry comes from, what did they say? I think somebody said that poetry is trouble on the page, and I kind of like that definition.
So how did you meet these women? Were you teaching them, or?
I wasn't. What happened was I'm in a 12-step program, and I've been in the program since 2005, and the program that I'm in relies on three things for success. It relies on unity, it relies on recovery, and it relies on this wonderful thing that they call service. And service can be anything from making the coffee to, I don't know, just to talking to people in meetings. But I had a sponsor who was very heavy on service work in general. And my background of, I'm a recovering alcoholic, and I'm what they call a blackout drinker, which means that, unfortunately, I don't drink too much and fall over unconscious. I drink too much and then I do stuff that I don't remember. So, which can be very, very dangerous, not just to yourself but to other people, especially if you've got a thing about driving drunk. You know, it's a real big problem. So my sponsor, who was aware of this, said that I should take an AA meeting into the jails. She said that, for the grace of God, it would have been me in an orange jumpsuit, because I'm a blackout drinker, and so many times I have no recollection of what it was that I did while I was drinking. So she thought that it would be an apt thing for me to go into the local jails and hold 12-step meetings there. And I did that for about a year, and it was very humbling, and she was absolutely right. There's something about seeing women in orange that that really makes you think about the decisions and the choices that you've made in your life. And as I said, you know, it's trouble on the page, and quite a lot of my, well, probably in this collection, Bone Song, I'd say probably 60% of my poems come from a journey towards recovery, and then the trip from rehab into full recovery. You know, I consider myself recovered today. This 24 hours, I've recovered. Who knows about tomorrow? Goodness knows, we're not there yet. You know, I'll deal with that when we get there.
Did you start writing poems before you were in recovery?
I did. I wrote what I call... I use this description with my students. I tell them that that I used to write shoebox poems. And my definition of a shoebox poem is the poem you write at 2 o'clock in the morning when your boyfriend's dumped you. And you write this really bad poetry. And then the best thing you can do with it is to fold it up and put it in a shoebox under your bed. And then you pull it out the next time that he dumps you and that kind of thing. So I'd written a lot of those kind of poems, the woe is me poems. But I didn't really start writing poetry until I was 40, maybe even 41. And I found myself at college for the first time in my life. And I discovered that I love to read. And I discovered that I even quite like poetry, to read it. And I got in with a group of fellow non-traditionally aged women at college, and we were all writing together. And so I started writing before then. That was in 2000. And then I went into rehab in 2005. So I'd kind of cut my teeth on poetry, and I'd learned the dance steps. But it wasn't really until I hit rehab that really the poem started to happen. I think they're communication, Jennifer. And I think if you're often with alcoholics and addicts, we don't know how to communicate. That's why we drink and use. So to write poems is an opportunity to put into words your reality. And that's, I guess, what I did. I wrote myself through recovery. And I'm still doing it. I think it's, you know, if ever I know of anybody going through stresses and trials and tribulations and they can't talk about it, I see the best thing you can do is to write about it. And it definitely works for me.
So
I got a book out of it, Jennifer.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. It's an amazing book. It's a powerful book. I mean, I got to tell you, when I first read the very first poem in it, and I remember thinking, oh, okay, I'll sit down and read the poetry and then go on to the next thing I was going to do on my list. And I sat down and read the first one, and I just had to stop.
Can I read it to you?
Yeah, but I'm telling you, I didn't tell you, I've never told you this, but no, I read that first one, and then I just kind of stopped, and I was by myself, I was sitting in bed, and I read it, and I had to just stop, and then I had to remind myself to breathe, to exhale.
Oh, wow.
And then I stopped, I thought, well, maybe I should read this again. I thought, I don't know if I can read this again. So then I couldn't sleep, so I had got up and read it again. And again, yeah, that's one of the most powerful. It's searing almost, you know. But
yeah,
go ahead.
Let's do that. This poem was never going to be the first poem in this book, and yet after workshopping it a few times, I came to the title and called it first. And then when I was putting together the manuscript and wondering, well, what should I put first? I thought, well, that's a higher power moment. You know what to put first. It's that poem. And I really do think that this poem for me began my journey, and I didn't realize it when this event occurred.
I mean, I thought, okay, if she does not believe, if this is a lady who does not believe in burying the lead, then I'm going to have to really mark out some time to sit with this book. It's not going to be just... Look it through.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, this one's called First. If you ask for my first, I will tell you this. It was summer, a front room, the boy's mother gone to work, her curtains closed against neighbors and the hum of morning traffic. The boy was blonde, pink and downy-cheeked. We were a headlong rush of sweated skin and hands. We took Polaroids, huddled, giggling and naked on the couch, to count down each photo's slow development. One elephant, two elephants, three elephants. We married in less than a year. He wore a suit his mother chose. I wore my sister's wedding gown. I will not tell you of the man who trapped songbirds in the woods at the back of my best friend's house. I will not tell you how the first, a wren, was a lesson, how he let me hold her, sweetly funneled from his caged hands to mine, how her wings drummed frantic against my palms. I will not tell you how he asked for sex, how I told him no, how he wrung her neck, stripped me naked in the grass, how he inched inside like a knife to an oyster, how he pushed the bird's thin-boned body into the O of my mouth, how a child learns the price of saving birds. I will not tell you any of this.
And again, I have to remind myself to breathe after this.
Yeah. It's, you know, I think as children, we really don't, we really have a different reality to the reality that we have when we're adults. We have a different way of looking at the world. And I have to tell you that I didn't feel that this particular event did me any damage until much, 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 much later, you know, when I had that ability to think about it and to connect it and to think about it in terms of the arc of my life. But, the great thing is that I think I said to you about 4 or 5 minutes ago that, you know, I'm 55 and I'm happier than I ever have been. I'm an absolute firm believer that I would not be who I am now had that not happened. And that if it hadn't happened, if something had intervened, if he had gone for someone else, then I wouldn't be who I was today. And I'm not sure that I want to run the risk of not being who I am today. Does that make any sense? It's like we are the sum of where we've been. And if you take away any of those locations, then we would not be who we are. And I like myself today. It's a thorny thing to think about.
At first I wasn't sure, and then when you started to say that, but I know you're right, because I know you are. I know you're right,
right
there. Because there were things that I don't share. I don't share a lot about my life, and I spend a lot of time being bitter. Just very bitter. And and yet now I can look at certain parts of it and see, had it not been for that, maybe a lot of my sensibilities now would be very different. Very different. And I can also see how much better off in a lot of ways I am than the people that made my childhood the way it was.
Right, right. I didn't come to this place of kind of acceptance until I got sober. When I went into rehab in 2005, I really thought that all I needed to do was to stop drinking, stop using, and get back to my life. I really thought that was all I needed. I would have shortchanged myself if I would have got that old life back. By getting clean and sober, I learned how to live my life, you know. And one of the things that they tell you is that your secrets will get you drunk again. You know, the things that you haven't dealt with or that you haven't brought out into the light. So for me, poems like that one You know, once it's down there, once it's on the page, it's out. The event has lost its power for harm for me. And so I think other people do it in different ways. You know, they paint pictures, they dance, maybe they play soccer. I don't know, but we all deal with our secrets in different ways. Mine is to put them out there. You know, I put them out there, and once they're out there, they can't do anything to me anymore. So yeah, I hate to think that poetry is therapy. I don't think it should be. I think that poetry should be therapeutic, you know, for everybody involved, the writer and the reader. But I think it's an art form, and therefore mm-hmm. if it's purely therapeutic, it probably isn't a very good poem yet. It needs some work.
Explain, I mean, to me, a lot of the audience may, a lot of people listening may know the difference, but I don't. What would be the difference between poetry
yeah.
being therapy
well,
and being therapeutic?
It's pretty easy. The first draft of this poem was therapy, absolute therapy. I didn't give a damn where the line broke. I didn't care whether there were stanzas in it, where the white space was. I didn't care that some of it was going to be in italic and some of it wasn't. I didn't care whether I wanted to have the same vowel sound in the line. When I went back in revision and made those decisions, those craft decisions, then it became a poem and stopped being therapy. So the initial idea, the impetus for the poem, where the poem is conceived, the image that it springs from, that can often be pure therapy. You know, I have this on my mind, I have this image I can't get rid of, I'm going to write it down. And then for me, sometimes having written it down, I'll go back to it and think, you know, I think I might have a poem there. And at that point, distance starts to move in. You know, I can't be harmed by the event if I'm wondering whether, you know, the word drummed frantic is better than beat frantic, you know, that kind of decision. So I guess that's what I mean, is that an early draft of a poem can be therapy, but unless you go in and revise it and you apply the art and the craft of poetry to it, it will never be a poem. It will just be therapy. It will be one of those shoebox poems, you know, the thing that you write at 2 in the morning. So I tell my students, don't you be bringing me your therapy poems. I want the poem that you've revised for hours, you know, that sprung from your therapy poem. So I get, does that make sense?
Yes, I see. Yeah, now.
Good.
Yeah, that does make sense now.
And some of them never make it as poems. They just always end up as therapy. You know, I've still got shoeboxes mm-hmm. full of therapy poems. And some of them just have something about them that I want to work harder with.
You know, I have a another comment and a question from uh-huh. from our friend David Perry. And
okay.
he says, I just read it. He says, can you tell you've really gotten to me here, Bunny?
Well, I suppose I'm happy about that, but yeah.
Okay. So David says, I find the fact that she hadn't started writing until her 40s fascinating, and this has happened with a good number of famous writers. I wrote heavily as a teen and beyond, but most of it was junk. He says, Bunny,
okay.
do you think your quote-unquote late start, and then he puts the parentheses, it's never too late, do you think that saved you from writing a lot of junk, gave you a chance to mature to a quality level, supplied you with worthy weaponry, so to speak?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I guess that I have a sense that perhaps if I had started to write when I was 20, I wonder whether maybe I'd be at the same point that I am right now, in that it wouldn't have made much difference. I don't think I would have had the patience to concern myself with the issues of craft and the hard work of writing. I think I would have just written more. I don't know, it's a really interesting question. I'm being a little bit guarded too, because of course I teach. So my students graduate when they're very young, you know, and they're good, they're fine poets. And I want them to go out and I want them to live. And then I want them to carry on writing. You know, I want them to have some stuff worth writing about. And so they need to live for that. So I don't know. I don't think I would have done anything differently from a living point of view. I don't think I would have achieved anything differently from a writing point of view. I just don't think I was old enough until my 40s to really look at life and fashion it into something that I was willing to share with other people.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. I have someone else calling here to speak with you, Bonnie.
Good.
And hi, this is Madam Perry here with Professor Bonnie Goodjohn. And who am I speaking with, please?
This is Kenya. Kenya Coleman.
Hello. Hi, Kenya. How are you?
Hi, Bonnie. How are you guys?
Doing well. How are you?
I am wonderful. I am totally enjoying the conversation. Even though I came in late, Bonnie, I wanted first to congratulate you on your new book. But more importantly, I really want to tell you, I wanted to just say thank you for sharing a lot of personal inspirations that kind of sent you in the direction that you're in now, because there's something about having a talent that inspires others.
Right.
That totally motivates other people to do the same. And I have just sat in and listened and just wanted to tell you that it all was for a reason. You had to
right.
do and go through to,
yeah.
to get where you are, to
mm-hmm.
say what you're saying, to affect me and other people, but you couldn't have done that without that journey. That is amazing. Bless you. That's
thanks.
A really powerful story.
Thank you. I'm continually coming to terms with this sense that we are all so connected, you know, that what I do,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, what I do 10 years ago might not seem to be very relevant, but it will be relevant at some point to someone. And that
yes.
I didn't know Jennifer 15 years ago, but I know her now, and there's a reason for that.
Exactly.
So, yeah, it sounds a little bit tree-huggy to a Brit like me, but you know, I'm getting more comfortable with that idea of connectivity. And the other thing I'd love to say is that I am blessed. I am blessed
yes.
being, well, I'm blessed that I'm sober today and breathing. I mean, that's the biggest thing for me. But,
mm-hmm.
but the ability to teach in a really fine, small liberal arts college here in Lynchburg and have everybody on faculty know all this about me and have my students
mm-hmm.
know all this about me and
yes.
still be able to do what I need to do in the classroom, I think is an absolute gift, in that there are so many people out there who have had things happen in their lives that never get that opportunity, that openness, or that ability to be open with, even with the people they love, about who they are and what they are. And I got to tell you, I mean, I'm not here doing, my point here is not to do a big plug for 12-step programs, but they taught me how to stand up behind a microphone and tell it like it was, you know?
Yeah.
And it's such a healthy thing to be able to do. But you've got to have friends around you who are willing to hear it. And that's one of the reasons I'm blessed. I have friends around me who are willing to hear this stuff and not judge me on what I've done in the past. But judge me on
yes.
what I do today, right now, this 24 hours, and it's all we've got, you know. So thank
yes,
you,
exactly
Kendra, for that.
Right.
It means a lot to me. It affirms that I'm not making an absolute ass of myself. I'm making a big mistake on air, you know. And
you
if I am,
not.
I am.
You are not. But I wanted to say one more little thing about the 12-step program. I just
yeah.
feel like in life, regardless of what our struggle was, what we were going through, we all have to go through some type of 12-step program to survive it.
I, We should, Kendra, we need to get T-shirts printed with that on it, you know? Everybody needs to
watch that program. Yes, I mean, you just, regardless of whatever you've been through, you really do have to go through those steps to get back in line. And I really appreciate what you're saying today. It was really great. Thank you.
And as a life coach, Kenya, as a professional life coach,
this is what you really see
that in people, don't you?
I do, but I'm so impressed that she has been around the right people at the right time, and you have opened your spirit to this amazing forgiveness and this amazing understanding that says that, okay, I went through that, but it's okay, and I'm blessed. I'm over here saying you really are blessed, believe me, because that's not an easy spot to get at where you are at right now.
Mm-hmm. It's not. It's a hard place to get to, but it's worth the work to get to today. It really is.
Well, I'm not going to hold the phone. I just wanted to say you're doing a wonderful job. I love the conversation.
Thank you, Kendra.
Thank you so much, Kenya.
Okay, guys.
Listen, Madam Terry. Thanks.
Yes, ma'am, I will. I'm not going anywhere. You guys enjoy. Okay.
All right.
Meeting you, Bonnie.
And you, Kendra.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. And, she's... that is, some people know that's Kenya Colbert, who is a very dear friend of mine. And she takes her, you know, that's whatever she says is from the heart. I can certainly tell you that.
Right.
But, yeah, and there's so many things I keep, I'm scribbling all these notes of things that you said that I want to touch back on. Yes, young people, I always feel like young people, and sometimes I even think babies, you know, it's like you've got a separate world that the adults don't know about. You know, there's like a whole different reality.
Yes, yes. And back to what I was saying before about that poem first.
Yes.
It didn't affect me as a child in the way that it affected me as an adult. It's a different world. And thank God, you know, thank God.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there is a level of innocence and acceptance as a child that we lose. You know, and we lose it for good reason when we become an adult. But it's, if we could get that balance between, you know, the child us and the adult us, I think we would all be so much happier so much sooner.
Yeah. We think, yeah. Well, we think we would. Maybe we would, hopefully.
Right.
So did you, now, in 2005, when you went into rehab or came out, were you already you had already gotten your college degree, or you were already in college?
You know, I graduated from my undergraduate in 2004, and I have no idea how I managed that. And I graduated cum laude. I mean, it wasn't that I scraped through; I aced it.
Well done, congratulations.
Thank you. So that was 2004. I then took 6 months off because there was other stuff going on. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And I ended up enrolling in a master's program with the University of Southern Maine. I love the look of their Stone Coast low residency creative writing master's program. So I had enrolled in that, and I went there in the you got there for 2 weeks in January and 2 weeks in July. So I went on campus for 2 weeks in January 2005, and I was drunk for most of it. It was awful. It was just terrible. And when I came back, I knew that something had to change. So I booked myself into a rehab in March of 2005, and then I had to go back again in July, and, you know, it's, these writers can certainly drink, you know, so I was fresh out of rehab, and I didn't know what to do. I couldn't get back into the party scene that I had been in the January, not that they all drank crazy, I was the alcoholic in the group, you know, I drink crazy whenever I get the chance. So I spoke to another student, a guy called Jake Strunk, who was in the same kind of year as me. And he found a few more friends, and we all ended up renting a house together. just for the 2 weeks, and it meant that I could be there, I could mm-hmm. I could be in the lectures, I could do the work, but that I could get away from the environment of drinking and get back to this house and not drink, and then get back to the campus the following day. So Jake's drunk saved my life in that residency in more ways than one. So, yeah, I got sober in the middle of my education, really. So then my first book was published in 2007, although I got that publishing contract in 2005. It took a few years for that one to hit the stands. But by the time that book came out, I was 2 years into my sobriety. So, yeah.
And that was the book Sticklebacks and Snow Globes?
Yeah, that came out in 07 with a New York publisher who then sold it, sold publishing rights to Australia, which was wonderful, and also to Russia. So, yeah, so then I went through a bit of a fallow time in terms of fiction writing. I just couldn't seem to get the next book right. And so I didn't actually finish that properly until a few years ago. And what had happened for me, Jen, was that I finished Sticklebacks and Snow Globes, which was about a group of kids growing up in London in the 70s. So it was pretty much, a lot of it was autobiographical. And when I finished the book, I put the pen down, but the damn characters wouldn't stop. They had more stuff to talk to me about. So I tried to avoid them for a couple of years, and I couldn't do it. So the new book that comes out in November, whilst it's in no way a sequel to the first one, does use, you know, some of the same characters because they had stuff to talk about. And if I'm really happy with that, I love the book Little Altars Everywhere, which the next book on was The Yaya Sisterhood. And so that's the kind of arc that I'm on. The first book is finished, but the second book looks at some of those characters again. So yeah, not a sequel, but definitely a book that has chimes of the first book.
So they kept talking to you, you know, and that's another thing. I mean, I'm a voracious reader, and I always have been since I was a child, and
right.
And my husband is too. So you'll know we've got stacks of books on both sides of the bed.
Right.
And in fact, there have been times when, and I enjoy talking to him. He's a lot of fun. But there have been times when we've both been so into what we were reading at the time, and maybe we were
right.
going down the internet, and then we kind of, one of us will say to the other one, are you taking your book? You know, because we don't want to be rude, but we're reading something,
right.
and we're really into it, but we understand it, and so nobody's feelings are hurt.
Right.
Were you going to bring your book? Were you going to bring your book? You know, okay, let's just bring our books, and if we don't, you know. And so we love to read. And I've got so many things. I'm always, you know, got more books than I've read, and then especially after
right.
if I've been someplace like Book Expo, then, you know, you send home books and have them shipped home. They give you so many. But
right.
I didn't tell you this either. A couple of months ago, I went back to Sticklebacks and Snow Globes
mm-hmm.
and read the last two chapters
right.
again.
Because right.
I just wanted to feel that the, you know, the girls, Tot and her sister, I just wanted to, I don't know, I just kind of just want to go see them again and visit. But, you
yeah.
know, but I also loved, and especially because you're showing it through a child's eye, children do have a whole different world going on. And I think even babies, when, you know, if you've been like in a grocery store or something, and the baby's looking over somebody's shoulder, and they're kind of
yeah.
smiling at you and waving or whatever, like they got this whole
right.
conversation going on that the people holding them totally oblivious to.
Right,
and
right.
I'll let my imagination go into something like, it's somebody that when they came to Earth, they knew about me, you know, so we're just having a little chatter, or they kind of like, oh, yeah, yeah.
Right.
I know she's funny. Yeah, I'll talk to her. Hey, no, but the people there, like, if you walk by and wave to them, they look like, who the heck are you? So,
right.
It's like
they have
their
such
own
wise faces. I mean, they look at you as if they know things about you. It's very unsettling.
Exactly. And it is unsettling, too. It definitely is to me. And so, yeah, so it's like their own world, and kids, too, because I remember we have there's all kind of things. If you've read Stephen Tobolowsky's Dangerous Animals Club, I mean, he and his friend made a point of capturing every kind of dangerous animal they could find. And that was part, that was the object of their club. And,
right.
I mean, you know, tarantulas or certain kinds, you know, rattlesnakes, whatever, that was, this was their mission. Whereas, you know, if their parents knew, they'd probably be mortified.
Yeah.
But, and, you know, and I remember just always having, of course, mine was, I was always the, you know, the shy, geeky kid that was, you know, I was every bully's target. So, but my best friend,
oh,
Patty.
Right.
Yeah, my best friend, though, across the street, Patty, we had our own little world, you know, so it was all about, we were the girls from Uncle, or.
We were Charlie's Angels when I was a kid. We used to pretend to be Charlie's Angels, me and my two friends.
Yeah, Charlie's Angels, yeah, no, we were, I think Robert Vaughn, yeah, Napoleon Solo and Ilya Kuryakin were our first loves. And, but yeah, but still, it's our own world. And then I remember there was a girl I knew, one friend I made in school, and she would make these cartoons of different stories, Shakespeare. She would make cartoons of Shakespeare. And I think, and my parents found one and got a hold of it. They were all upset. And they're trying to get me to tell the truth about what's going on. Well, apparently somebody's trying to kill somebody. And then it was like and somebody's trying to blow somebody's mind and make them kill themselves. You know, somebody's got a skull. Who do you know that has a skull that carries it around? And I go, well, I don't want you. How do you say? You know, it's like. You know, I don't know, but who was Horatio? Because, you know, in our neighborhood, there was nobody named Horatio. So, yeah,
right.
They would sit me down and just grill me for hours. And then the other thing, I think, was in eighth grade, they got a letter saying that there was a Chinese class taught in our high school. And so I guess not many people signed up, so they... they sent letters to all the people who were good in English thinking that maybe we could, somehow they thought that meant we could learn Chinese, and they didn't want to lose the teacher.
Right.
And so they sent one to my parents. Well, good God almighty. That was back during the big scare where these little letters going all around the neighborhood. Khrushchev says, I will reach you through your children and take over your country.
Oh,
so
God.
They were going, that's why shit, they want her to learn Chinese. She must be a member of the Communist Party. And of course, these days people have no idea back then something like that could just totally ruin you.
Right,
and
right.
All you had to do was just even hint. You know, this was early 60s, and it was like every now and then there'd be some shakedown. I'd come home and everything would be dumped out of my room looking for some communist paraphernalia. If I had wanted to join the Communist Party, Bunny, I would have had no idea where to go. Absolutely. I would not have known. This is before internet. I would not have known the first place to go find an actual card-carrying communist.
Right.
If you paid me.
I think our parents credit us with a lot more sense than we actually had.
They thought there was a lot more going on with me than there actually was, I guess. But, and that's so funny. And, of course, I don't mean to get to me, but that's one thing, too, is that lately I've begun writing some essays, and I haven't gotten to a lot of the material from my younger days, but or much from the young part, but I am putting all these things down to a story. My husband said, you know, when you tell these to people, you always tell it in a way that makes people laugh.
Right,
like this, even though it was like, then it was like I never knew when I got home, what were they going to find? What was I going to be accused of then, you know? All right, get the belt. She's going to tell us who the communists are. It's just this Gresham Park in southeast Atlanta. We didn't have any communists that I knew of. But anyway, yeah, you can beat me all you want. I don't know it. And then I would start making up names so they would go to school looking for people that didn't exist. But, as we should say, enough about me. Let's get back to you. Let's get back to the real subject of our meeting tonight. Well, you were talking about, one thing I wanted to ask you about is, we talk about critics.
Yeah.
People who are critics. You said you don't, I've read that you don't like critics who thumb their nose at certain poets. Like,
yeah.
And I know I don't like people who give me an attitude because I like some of the well-known, you know, I think your people in the United Kingdom have some fantastic, some of the best writers in the world, you know, because
right.
You've got, I mean, who would be your favorite British writer?
Oh, goodness,
Chaucer, Shakespeare, Jack Collins, it's going to have
to be Thomas Hardy. I mean, Hardy is my...
Okay.
Yeah, or Lawrence, D.H. Lawrence.
All right. I'm waiting
yeah.
for Jackie Collins. Nothing?
You're waiting for whom?
Jackie Collins.
Well, you see, Jackie Collins was the book I used to take to bed with me, you know, and read under the covers so my mum wouldn't see me reading it. I learned about sex and life from Jackie Collins. So I have a soft spot for our Jackie.
Well, so do I. I mean, I'm saying it kind of tongue-in-cheek, but yes and no.
Right.
And actually, I when I met her once, I gave her a book to autograph. It was one of her new books. And then I asked her to autograph one of her old books I'd gotten from a used bookstore, and
right.
it was in Spanish. And she said, why are you reading my book in Spanish? I said, well, you know, I minored in Spanish in college. And I'm like you, Bunny. I didn't go to college until later.
Right.
In fact, when the first day of class, the other students always thought that I was the teacher because
right,
I was
yeah.
because I was older. And they go, and but learning the first since I'm minored in Spanish and I didn't want to lose what I had learned, I found some Jackie Collins books, and if that doesn't help your vocabulary, you're just not trying.
Yeah, yeah, you should. You know, if you can read Jackie Collins in Spanish, you can make your way through most Spanish cities after that, I would imagine. I mean, it's the language of the people who speak that language. You know, that's why I get so not upset. I just get bored of hearing, you know, that, you know, Billy Collins is not a good poet because he's too accessible, or Mary Oliver is not a good poet because, you know, it's her work is too easy. It's too there's nothing left underneath the surface. Yeah, you know, I just want people to read poetry. I don't really care what they read. I just want them to read. That's really my thing. So yeah, I'm not into things that are really difficult to understand. I don't want to read something and feel like an idiot. And I don't want my readers to feel like an idiot either.
So why do people react to something that's accessible if they say, you know, as you mentioned, Billy Collins, Mary Oliver? Because,
yeah.
Like I said, I don't know as much about poetry, as many poets as you do, or my friend Colin Kelly, but I first heard Billy Collins on an episode of Prairie Home Companion.
Yeah, I think I
and
did too.
Was enchanted.
Yeah.
By him. By listening to him there. And then, you know, then I read, you know, what you told me, well, some people, you know, thunder notes or whatever. Why? What is,
yeah.
I guess the people that...
You know, I think it's all about exclusivity.
Uh-huh.
And that's why I hate it as well. I think that there's still a remnant of, you know, poetry is academic, it's for the elite, it's for the cultural, it's not for the masses. And I think that... But it is for the masses. You know, Walt Whitman wrote for the people. Allen Ginsberg wrote for the people. I think that there are too many people around who want to keep it to be a, you know, like an exclusive club, poets only.
Mm-hmm.
But I just don't think that's a good thing.
You have, and I've noticed many writers that I enjoy, writers, poets, do this as well. You have some poems that you've written that were sort of homage to other writers, or maybe a riff off of someone else's work.
Yeah, I do that quite a lot. We get away with paying homage to poets, whereas in any other genre, I think we'd be called plagiarists. but poetry has that long tradition of mimesis. You know, in the new poets would study under an old poet, and they would write imitations of the old poet's works, and learn their trade like that. So I like doing that. And so Allen Ginsberg, I did my creative thesis on Allen Ginsberg and Walt Whitman, so there's lots of Ginsbergian things in Bonesong. I love his work, so it's hard to read somebody a lot and not have their work influence your own.
That's true. Well, let me see. I'd like for you, if you wouldn't mind, to read something else before you go, before we end, because we've got about 9 minutes left.
Yeah. Well, why don't I read that Ginsbergian one? One that came from Ginsberg. Let me just see. I've got the book in front of me. Page 16. So this poem is a tribute to three things. It's a tribute to Allen Ginsberg. Allen Ginsberg decided at one of the phases of his life that when you had finished delivering the reader a full image, then you broke down onto another line. So he had this way of writing in these big, chunky, hanging paragraphs. So it's an homage to him. And that will mean nothing unless you can actually see this poem on the page. The other thing it's an homage to is The Misfits, the movie. I love the movie The Misfits. And it's also an homage to my second marriage. So here it is. It's called Misfits. We watched Clark Gable hobbling horses, Marilyn discovering the sad romance of pet food, all three cowboys hankering for one thing that wasn't her, an age when pets ate table scraps, when man hobbled Mustang for man to possess, not for so many cans of dog meat. You asked me what the hell that was all about, and I explained it was a commentary on change, on how we yearn for things we can never have, how the blade of expectation cuts a man, or Mustang, down to so much meat. And something finally opened in you, like some street corner hydrant, and out pumped your world, a bitter sister, the still god of a father you worship, though I have never understood why, the mother whose decision to cauterize her own hemorrhoids with nail scissors hadn't filled you with the stoic pride you always recounted at parties, but with a 7-year-old's dread. If a mother could do that to herself, what could she do to him? And all this is pouring from your mouth, and you're not looking at me. You're looking at the coffee table and holding a dog's ears. And it's as if your honesty has watered some long dormant pod lodged in my throat, its stems and leaves twining up inside my windpipe. And while I might wish that these leaves were good leaves, that they might spill from my lips across the carpet like morning glory and weave around your ankles and tighten, pull me from my recliner and you from your sofa island and bind us together as I have told everyone, friends, therapist, sponsor, strangers, that we need to be bound. It's too late. And all I can do is nod and nod and clamp my mouth shut to keep all these new leaves withering inside. And you stretch, walk the dog out to the porch. I turn down the sheets, my teeth unbrushed, the day's blue shadows still around my eyes, and wonder what it was I ever wanted from you. I switch off the bedside lamp, listen to the front door open, close, its deadbolt slide, the dog's claw clatter down the hallway, your soft sock tread, your clothes falling in the darkness, the groan of springs as you climb into bed. And the dog pads round, climbs up too, her yellow fur black in this night, her claws sharp against my back. And across the wall, shadows cast by cars on the expressway race along the walls like silent Mustangs, canter smooth above the dresser, along the wall, across the empty sheets between us.
And tell us the title again.
It's called Misfits, which is the title of the Clark Gable and Marilyn Monroe movie, which is a wonderful movie. I can't remember who directed it, but it's one of those iconic American classics.
And I should have remembered who directed that. Didn't that also have Montgomery Clift?
It did, yes. And they're all out there.
Thelma Ritter?
They're all out there catching horses to kill for pet food. It's rather nasty, but yeah. And my ex-husband watched it with me because he thought that he should, and then he turned to me at the end of it. He said, "What was all that about?"
John Huston.
That's it, John Huston. How did I forget that?
John Huston.
Yeah.
And as I recall, that was the one that allegedly was held up because of Marilyn, and she was in the, that's when she went into a mental hospital for a while.
Wow, I didn't know that, Jennifer.
At the time, so she was blamed for everything that went wrong. However, the backstory that comes out is that Huston had a lot of gambling debts. And somehow, and I forget how the whole scheme worked, but somehow by making sure she got into a mental hospital, they could blame for the insurers and you know, the people, the backers of the film, producers, they could blame it all on her.
Right.
That the film was slow and hadn't been made yet. And keep as long as they could keep her in there.
Gosh,
until finally her ex Joe DiMaggio said, "I'll tear this place apart brick by brick to get her out."
Yeah.
And I used to be a professional impersonator. And that's why I read so much about her one time.
Right.
I was a professional Monroe.
Wow.
So
wow, Jennifer.
And Madonna some, but mostly Monroe. I did Dolly Parton once, but that's rough on the back.
I can imagine. I think if you can do Marilyn Monroe, you could do Madonna.
Yeah, there were a lot of similarities. So someday we'll tell some funny stories together.
And
that will be one. But for right now, the main thing people need to know is that the new book of poetry is called Bone Song.
Mm-hmm.
And your launch event this Thursday, the day after tomorrow, in Lynchburg, at the Lynchburg YWCA. The event is titled Bone Song, A Blind Date. And also J.R. Bryant will be there. There will be yummy, nibbly things.
There will.
And starts about 7. What's the address on the YMCA? YWCA.
Oh, goodness me. Isn't it when you live in a town, you don't know the street names? YWCA downtown, and it's across from the Bank of the James. And the Bank of the James is one of our few skyscrapers, so it's easy to find.
And I understand that YWCA is a pretty special place. They have a lot of programs
I'll go back to my thing about how many women end up in jail because of alcohol and drugs. And the Y does a beautiful, beautiful service in that it takes some of those women and gives them a fresh start, you know. Mm. Don't get me started on that. I could talk for another hour on that.
Then you'll got to come back sometime, buddy. You'll have to come back.
That would be wonderful.
Because everyone, when you came on the show that had Art Harris and Susie Parker, everyone was enchanted with you. And if you want Bunny to come to your town or your store, let us know about it. Let me know about it. And I will have her website, which is bagoodjohn.com. I'll put that on the page. And also Twitter at bagoodjohn. Definitely you need to tweet because you get these nice little small bits of poems from her little observances on life. Oh, and go to Bunny's website because if you don't go, you won't get to read her short 200-word blogs and you won't get to read this fantastic story. I can't believe we left this out. Bunny, please promise me you'll come back and talk about this.
her stories of where she played along with the catfish.
Oh, the catfisher. Yes, I would love to come back and tell you how to catfish the catfisher.
Please.
It was
please.
Great fun.
Would you come back? Can you come back next Tuesday and talk about the catfisher, please?
Yes.
Honest?
No, I can't. I'm off to a residency, but maybe when I get back from the residency, I would love to.
Oh, and I had a British band on next week to have on, so that would have been so much fun. I would have known what anyone was saying. So, but I'd still have a good time. So,
I will.
So, Be A Good John Twitter and website. You must go read about the catfish. Also, thanks to Better Choices for Life, the podcast, on the new and noteworthy section of iTunes, and Mexico Lifestyle Services, which I hope will be making a place for Bunny and I to come down sometime and have a book event and have her read. And thank you so very much, Bunny Good John, for being my guest, and thanks to everyone for listening to Madame Perry's Salon. Bunny,
thank
final
you.
Word?
Just thank you so much. This has been a real pleasure. You have introduced me to online radio, and I will always be grateful.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Thank you so much for saying that. That's very sweet. That's very nice of you. It makes me feel very good. All right, folks, and back to me.